This session of the 2013 Adelaide Festival of Ideas was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
Hello everyone and welcome to Old Bones, Shooting Stars and New Technologies. I'm Alice Gorman from Flinders University, and Flinders is also a sponsor of this afternoon's event. And I'm here, I think, principally because I'm an archaeologist who works on space exploration. So everything our speakers are going to talk about today will have some intense interest and intersection with the very things I'm interested in too. We have three wonderful speakers who will talk in total for approximately 20 minutes. After that time, we will ask for questions from the audience, and there will be someone running with mics around. If you want to ask a question, please raise your hand, and I'll indicate when it's right for you to do that. So what I'd like to do now is to start off with the fascinating ideas that we're going to talk about today. This session is about new technologies, it's about science and creativity coming together, and it's about creating new visions of how we look at the world. We're going to be looking up in space, we're going to be looking at the material of the Earth, we're going to be looking at how bodies and bones are put together and how they work. I'll introduce all three of our speakers now, and they will speak for about 10 minutes each. First of all, we have Professor Tim Sendon, who is the head of the Department of Applied Mathematics at ANU. His research area is experimental surface science, and this has led him into the area of investigating nanoparticles, medical scanning, also fossils, and he's currently building a laboratory which will investigate 3D data analysis, including the very hot topic of 3D printing. Then we have Professor John Long, Strategic Professor of Paleontology at Flinders University. He's very interested in how fish made the transition into becoming land mammals. And he's also a much-awarded writer and science communicator. And his book is available, I believe, as part of the Festival Bookshop, which you will find in the foyer of the Freemasons Hall on North Terrace. And finally, we have Professor Phil Bland, who is from the Department of Applied Geology at Curtin University and also an ARC Laureate Fellow. He's studying meteorites, and his interest in them is about the origins of the solar system. He's in the process of building a network of cameras that will cover a third of Australia's night sky, a very bold undertaking. So I'd like to ask Tim if he would like to come forward to the lectern and tell us about his exciting research.
Thank you very much, Alice. Look, thank you for the invitation to talk. It's been a really fantastic program. The organisers have done such a spectacular job of getting such an interesting program together. I'm very happy to be a participant, actually. Anyway, I think what I'd like to start with is basically my role in a collaboration I have had with John for a long time, but also to set a scene for data visualisation and maybe a discussion about big data and where we're going with access to big data. We start with an image on the screen you see there, and that's a very interesting installation work by two artists, UK artists. And it really, I like to show it because it sets a scene for how our perception kicks in and overrides reason to some extent. And what you see is, in fact, of course, is a very familiar silhouette of two people sitting on a step. But of course, the truth about the origin of that data, if you like, that image, is completely different. It's orthogonal, utterly orthogonal to the familiar shapes of those two people. And in this case, we've used white light to project a silhouette. If we were to use X-rays, then in fact, what we'd see is a radiograph, and the complexity of that junk arranged in a haphazard way would completely dominate the way our perception would see that radiograph. We would not any longer see the envelope of two people sitting on a step. In fact, our perception would be lost. We wouldn't see it as a familiar structure at all. And I think this shows very clearly how scientists are challenged by new data and new ways of seeing things. You have to keep your perception out of it to some extent. But on the other hand, if you don't put your perception into it, then you can't innovate. You can't take that conceptual leap. So it's quite instructive, I think, to look at art for inspiration in terms of how we digest our world. Now, This is the process I'll be taking through quickly. It's a situation where we take a series of radiographs using x-rays, and what you see there is a lizard's head, common garden skink, revolving in front of you. Now, that's a series of radiographs. It's not three-dimensional data. And if I spin it again, your mind can imagine it spinning one way or the other. And so, again, your perception has kicked in and given you the illusion of 3D. However, there is a mathematical trick, a computer algorithm which supports it, that allows us to reconstruct those radiographs into something which is coherently and consistently three-dimensional, a true and faithful representation of that structure. So this is a process I'm taking you through now. This is one slice through a three-dimensional data set, so a block of data. And so you can see as we take lots of independent views, radiographs at different angles, as the sample spins around, more and more data is added into that image, and of course a familiar object starts to emerge. Most of you won't recognise it from a single slice, but if I put all the slices together, what we can do is we can drive a cut plane, a slice through this organism. Now, has anyone guessed what it is at this stage? Very familiar, garden. So that's, you know, one of the most humblest things you'd find in your garden. Lovely creatures. Children have been delighted with them for many years because there's similarity to trilobites and, you know, prehistoric life. But they are actually a very old creature and fascinating for me. I think to look inside these internal crustacea and look into the internal organisms is fascinating. We can talk about that, and it's a subject of an art installation a resident artist, Erica Seckham, has undertaken in our group. That's another topic. With x-rays, what you see is internal structure. So it's not just the hard stuff, it's the soft stuff as well. And unlike a Hollywood animation where you just see a surface, what we capture with these x-rays is all the soft detail inside, and we can select, we can visualise different parts of that organism. Now, we didn't do this and develop these technologies just to look at sladers and insects, although personally I probably did. This is more about getting some external funding into the group to some extent. And the big data, the big processing, not just the big imaging, but the analysis that follows, we've applied to topics such as oil recovery and groundwater and so on. Probably more relevant, and I think probably more justifiable in many respects, is some of the work we've been doing on biological materials. So by taking a three-dimensional view and then subjecting that object, in this case a piece of bone, to a crush test, you can see how the deformation proceeds to that structure. And we can model that in the computer. The next image is a piece of coral. Now, coral is used in many countries for facial reconstruction, when particularly the zygomatic arch or cheekbone, when that's crushed in a car accident, that bone needs to be reconstructed and a template or scaffold is put in place. The question is what to use, and in many countries they use coral. Now, the choice of coral is very important because you've got to allow nutrients in and bad tissue, decomposing tissue, out and allow the bone to be remodeled, of course. And so we ran a simulation which shows how different corals would perform under these different conditions. So, you know, useful information. And that's actually being put in place in clinical practice in Asia as we speak. So that's a very quick introduction to a technology that has driven a very nice collaboration with a wonderful group of scientists. Scientists are very different from physicists in many respects, but have the same emotional connection with their data. So I'd like to hand over to John Long.
Thank you, Tim. And it's been a wonderful collaboration with Tim. I'm a paleontologist, so I'm the old bones part of the talk. And the thing about paleontology is that people have always thought of it as being a simple observational science. You know, we go out, we dig up fossils, we describe them, we hypothesise about their value to solving a problem in evolution. And for many years, that's all paleontologists did. They'd look at a fossil, they'd photograph it, they'd draw it, and they'd make an interpretation. In the recent years, though, with the advent of this advanced technology, it's created a revolution in our understanding of evolution. That's the title of one of my books, actually, The Evolution Revolution. But not because of that, but because of the fact that we can mine fossils now for new layers of information. And when we look at patterns of evolution, we always think of the macro patterns, like bones that change going from the skull of a fish to a skull of an early tetrapod, ultimately to a reptile or a mammal up to a human. We can trace those patterns changing with time, and fossils are the direct evidence of that. Evidence of evolution is top down and bottom up. Top down, it's molecular evolution, the way that the genetic code can relate every organism to every other organism on the planet. Bottom up, it's the fossils that tell us the chronological or time sequence. Now, with these new techniques, it gives us a whole new window to look into histological evolution at the cellular level. It's really profound. It means that, for example, it's not just the macro patterns of evolution that give you a trend. It's also the micro patterns buried in the bone cells. A classic example is sharks. You look at sharks, they had a rapid burst of evolution when they first appeared 430 million years ago. And then by the time you get to the Devonian period, about 350 million years ago, 360, 370 million years, whatever, the sharks look essentially similar to sharks today. You know, physically very similar looking. But you take a tooth of any one of those sharks from the Devonian, and they lack the complex multi-layered enameloid that modern sharks have. And you see that the business end of a shark is its mouth, and the teeth have evolved in very subtle and quite distinctive ways to enable their evolution to proceed and for that group to diversify. So I'm going to show you now some examples of working with Tim Senden and his team at the VisLab at ANU, analysing some spectacular three-dimensional fossils and the sorts of information we can get from them. So these Devonian fishes, a fish called Gogonasis, which I originally named in 1985 because we only had the snout of it. It means snout from Gogo. In 86, I found a complete skull of it, and we've since found three or four more complete animals. But this is the front of the snout. There's the nostril there you can see, and the fangs of the front of the mouth. And then using this tomography, we can simply slice back so that we can look at structures like the nasal capsule of the endocranium. And that's that big cavity there, the nasal capsule. And you can see the nerve tube coming in, which is nerve one, the olfactorius nerve. There's a platform on that nostril that I'm going to show you again in a close-up, where you can see that the nostril isn't just a hole in the skull that goes into a round capsule. It's also got quite definite structures and features in there that we weren't really aware of before this, including teeth on a lamina in there. So let's go through. Just as this dissolves, just watch where that nostril is, and you'll see there's a flat lamina of bone there, and there's little teeth as well. We'll show you that up close in just a minute. This is that nasal structure of the same bit. We're looking at about a 2 by 2 millimeter sort of slice, and we're going now in. We're going to fly in through the nose of this 380 million year old fish, in through the olfactory nerve. There we go. And there's that lamina with the little teeth on it. I wrote a chapter on this in my book called Swimming in Stone, which I simply titled The Strange Fish with Teeth Up Its Nose. And if you want to know why there are teeth up its nose, you're going to have to read the book or talk to me later. All right. One of our more spectacular finds was, and I talked about this on Friday in my talk about the origins of sex, was we found an ancient fish 380 million years old with an embryo inside it. We discovered not only the oldest mother on the planet, but we'd also discovered the oldest live birth on the planet. It was a new fish, so we called it Martopisces, meaning mother fish, Attenborough Eye, after Sir David Attenborough, who was delighted to have this thing named after him. And there's a CT scan showing the umbilical cord in light green that was mineralised, still attached to the embryonic bones. We'd also discovered the origin of sex. This is the earliest evidence of copulation in a vertebrate. And further research along these lines led us to find the distinctions that first appeared in vertebrates that separated males from females, sexual dimorphism. Now, the next thing I'm going to show you is a bit of a placoderm from 400 million years old from southeastern Australia, from Tamis, called Buchanosteus, first named after the site Buchan in Victoria. You can see the eyeball there. There's the skull. And now we want to see what's inside that skull, because these early fish had well-ossified brain cases. And so as we cut a bit away, we can see the brain cavity, we can see the eye capsule, and we can see there's a suture between the nasal capsules and the brain cavity. And we can go right down to the cellular level if we wanted to and look at individual types of tissue that form that brain case. For example, tissues evolve. We have dentine under the enamel of our teeth, but Devonian fish had up to 20 different kinds of dentine. They were experimenting with histological evolution until they found the right one. This is a fossil eyeball, the oldest known eyeball of a vertebrate, in fact, that we described back in 1988. And using Tim's technology, we can cut this eyeball in half digitally, we can go inside it, and we can look at where muscles attached inside for the retractor bulbi muscles that made that eye function. We're about to embark on a new research project next year that can calculate whether these fish were actually nocturnally active at night or diurnally active during the day, and we look at the origins of niche partitioning in vertebrate communities. Finally, this one here is the oldest known fish skull belonging to the lineage of bony fish, which are our direct ancient ancestors. And again, this skull is the size of your little thumbnail. It's about a centimetre. You can see the scale there. And it showed the earliest evidence of an eye stalk, the eyeball connected by a stalk, which is a feature found in sharks today, but not in any bony fish. So it's fascinating that the level of anatomy we get is just stunning. Finally, let's go right down to the cellular level. This is a little piece of the snout of an ancient lungfish, and we can see the different kinds of sensory nerves and the dermis with the individual cells. And if we go up close, we can see the pore cells that make up the outer tissue or cosmene. Tiny little pores, there we go, see? And then the larger canals, which are sensory line systems. So we can start to look at the physiology of these fish, the kinds of advanced sensory systems they had, which we could never do before with just looking at external features of these things. I'd like to finish up with, it's not just the micro CT techniques we're using that are now more commonplace. You know, go back paleontology 20, 30, 50 years, and the most advanced things people did was to x-ray one and simply look through a flat fossil, and if they were lucky, they could see some structures. We're using very large particle accelerators now, like the synchrotron, both in Melbourne and also in Grenoble in France, to get a fossil that's still in the rock that hasn't been prepared out, shoot a high particle beam through it, and image it down to the cellular level. And we did this recently, and we published it only about 2 or 3 months ago in the journal Science. And what we found was complete sheets of muscle still attached in these 380-million-year-old fish. And that's what you're looking at that screen. Now, with other specimens we're working on right now, we've got complete alimentary canals. We've got the gut right through it. We've got the liver. We've got the heart preserved. It's going to revolutionise studying these ancient extinct fishes and rooting the human body plan even further back in an evolutionary framework. So it's a very exciting time to be a paleontologist. I'm going to hand over now to my other good mate, Professor Phil Bland, who'll tell you about something completely different.
Thanks, John. Well, I've got a crick in my neck now from turning around and trying to look at those incredible images, but my contribution is shooting stars and also some new technologies. And really what I want to try and give you a feel for today is how technology, developments in technology, change what's possible in a scientific project. So I'm going to tell you about this one project that I've been trying to do for 15 years now, and thankfully I finally got the opportunity to do it here in Australia. But the first ever grant that I wrote was in 1998, and technology then was quite different to what it is today. I started out as a geologist, and as a geologist, it's fundamental in trying to understand the geology of an area, of a continent, of the Earth, that you can connect the lab analyses of a rock to the context in which you found it. It's no use having a random bunch of rocks from all over Australia dumped in your backyard. You're not going to understand anything about the history, the geological history of Australia. You need to know where they all come from. I'm a planetary scientist and I study meteorites. We try and get at questions about how the solar system formed. And we get these samples, they're incredible. They've got this incredible record inside them, but we don't know where any of them come from. So that kind of fundamental basic context information is lacking. And that's what I was interested in trying to get with this project. So basically, planetary science, we're trying to find out really how we went from that to a nice ordered solar system that we can all happily live in and hope species can continue existing for several hundred million years into the future. And really at the moment we don't know. So from a scientific point of view, that's great fun because it means that there's lots of really big questions left to answer. Meteorites are fascinating because they are the oldest rocks in existence. If you've ever held one in your hands, then that's the oldest thing that you'll ever hold in your hands. There are chunks in them, in this case those kind of white raggedy inclusions that are the oldest materials that have ever been dated. And the age of the solar system and the age of the Earth actually comes from analysis of meteorites. So the last decent, super accurate age for the solar system was 4,567.6 million years, which is kind of bonkers. Please don't ask me how they can get that to a decimal place, because I don't know. A big question is where do meteorites come from? Can we give them the same sort of context that we would for a terrestrial rock? And a long time ago, people realized how we can do that. If we track meteorite fireballs coming through the atmosphere and we see them from several different directions, we can triangulate that, the position of that fireball in the atmosphere, track it back to work out where it came from in the solar system and forward to where it lands. And people have started doing that in 1953, building these big networks to try and get that information. Unfortunately, over the 60 years since then, the total recovery is, I think it's 6 meteorites. And so it's about a meteorite a decade for all of those giant programs. And basically the reason why they've not been terribly successful is that they always put them in places where it's almost impossible to find a small black rock on the ground. And that really is as simple that's as simple as the problem was. So the obvious solution is you put one in a place where it's a lot easier to find a small black rock on the ground. That also means that it's technologically more challenging, obviously, than putting a sophisticated camera in London or somewhere. Now, the first technologies we used when we were trying to do this were actually film cameras, because digital cameras, when we started, just didn't have the resolution. So we used these kind of giant Heath Robinson film cameras with a magazine of film inside them. So large format film plates, little vacuum on each plate to suck it down flat onto the plate, a magazine of 30 films like that. We'd send it out on the India Pacific every month, and cheap station owners would swap it for us. So it was this gigantic logistical network just to maintain 4 cameras in operation in the middle of the Nullarbor, and it was a nightmare. It would take basically a truck for one camera and 8 people to set it up, and that's kind of what it looked like in the end. One camera, so you had, you know, rows of solar panels, and if you forgot one bolt, then Bunnings is 1,500 kilometres away. So there were challenges involved in that. These are the images that we got, which are, I mean, one of the great joys of this for me is the imagery that we get. It's not strings of numbers from analysing a rock. The data is in the images, and the images are beautiful. And one of the things I'm going to try and do with this project is bring that to members of the public if I can. So as much as possible, anyway. So this was one of the first ones that we saw. These are star trails. It's a long exposure, so the stars kind of string out into trails. And this little thing here, that's the first fireball that we got, which is a little bit of comet coming in and vaporizing in the upper atmosphere. That's a little zoomed in one of that. I just really like the pictures, so that's totally gratuitous. The new fireball cameras that we've built are much simpler. We essentially now just use an off-the-shelf digital camera, fairly high-end but not like super expensive one, which means any time that, you know, companies like Canon or Nikon upgrade their stuff, we don't have to completely rebuild the cameras. We just unplug one and put a new one in, which is great. We can store a whole year's worth of data. So these cameras are taking images every 30 seconds. You'll have images over about a third of Australia, cameras covering about a third of Australia taken every 30 seconds. And that's going to be happening all the time. So anytime anyone wants to see what the night sky looks like, say over Blackstone in the middle of the Great Victoria Desert, you'll be able to click on a website and see what the night sky looks like over Blackstone, or indeed anywhere else. A big part of it is automating the whole data reduction. So this is, again, the technology part, is that the cameras are... we've got software now which lets the cameras reduce their own data, send us automated kind of breakdown of everything, so we just get, hopefully, in the end, an email in the morning that says, you know, this thing came from out beyond Jupiter and it's landed... over in Jinjin or something like that, which would be really nice. So the kind of images we get with these, it's kind of hard to display these actually in a talk, but they're awesome. And it's each image that you'll see is circular because we use fisheye lenses, so the whole horizon gets kind of wrapped around like that. If we zoom in, Then that's just one tiny area on the previous one. But that gives you a feel for the kind of detail that we get in every one of these. So you'll be able to zoom in on these images online. And that's one of the fireballs, so that's the kind of thing. Anyone who's seen a bright fireball for yourselves knows that they're one of the true wonders of nature. And even now when I see them out in the field, it just blows me away. So it's great to be able to do a project where we're actually getting data from those things. One of the surprises for us was that it's actually not just fireballs. We're able to do astronomy with these things. So this was a supernova that was discovered recently by a amateur Japanese astronomer. The reason he was an amateur was that most of the world's big telescopes, they're pointed at specific regions of interest, very narrow angle. So it's not the case that, you know, professional astronomers are looking all over the sky all the time. No one has the resources to do that. So a lot of major discoveries are actually made by amateurs. We were really chuffed to find that we actually had this thing on our cameras before anyone saw it. So that kind of blew me away. It means that there's actually a lot of astronomy we can do. So one of the things that that we're going to do now is get all of our data on a database. So like a year's data from all the cameras, it'll be about 500 terabytes. You'll be able to kind of say, okay, what's that bright thing there? Show me how the brightness of that varies every 30 seconds from 70 different cameras over the period of a year. And I have absolutely no idea what information we'll get from that, but I'm kind of optimistic that maybe we'll see exoplanets, or it'll just be really exciting. I think there's an awful lot we can get from that. And last but very much not least is another way we can draw people in and help other people participate in this, which is a smartphone app that we've developed that basically lets you track your own fireballs. So if you see a fireball, you'll be able to get information from it and send that to us. And if we get half a dozen different observations of it, we'll be able to get a trajectory, send you a message back saying your fireball came from beyond Mars, etc. So what we do, there's a whole bunch of things on this that let you keep up with the project. So we've got news and a picture gallery, so you've got some of the pictures, some of the nice pictures that we've seen. You can zoom in on all of those. Announcements, that was about the Chelyabinsk one, the Russian one that came in, so there's information on that. But the cute thing is this is tracking the fireballs. So you can hold this, hold your phone up. Say you've just seen one, hold it up to where you thought it started, click then, click where you thought it ended. We've got a little sliding thing that gives you animations for how long you thought it lasted, shape of it, and things like colour and brightness. And then you get, okay, this is my favourite bit, actually, because you can say how many fragments do you think you saw. So the animation changes, you know, depending on... So it's actually really cool just to play around with. But then you can review what you've seen and submit it. It shows you where you are. And then we'll be able to take that information and send it back to you in terms of what where your thing might have come from. The current one just does that, but we've done a souped up one now, which I think is just awesomely cute. And so it's kind of, you can see the stars moving around behind your phone while you before you click the button. It's again completely gratuitous. Well, it's that we will get a bit more accuracy on those measurements for that, but it just looks great. So that's why we did it. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you, everyone. We've had some very fascinating little slices through each of your own particular research. And we will start taking questions very shortly, and I'm sure you have many. But something that really struck me as I was watching and listening, we had a little special screen down here at the front, by the way, so it looks better on the big screen, but we could see everything that was going on too. What unites, I think, a lot of the different things you're doing is scales, the scale of across time and space, the particular objects that you can look deep into, and through that sometimes nanoscale view, draw conclusions about really big picture kind of stuff. And I think, you know, the images of the meteorites are very, particularly easy to think about that from, that very fine scale detail that actually tells us about something that goes back billions of years in time. But it's the same with fossils also. And then thinking about some of Tim's images as well, we have close to the present, we have recent coral species and the human skeleton that resemble each other enough that in some places they can actually be interchanged, which I think is quite extraordinary. So I found that quite compelling in watching and listening to everything that you were all saying. Would any of you like to comment on that notion of scale in your work?
I've got lots of scales in my fish, but that's another question. it is. As I said, in paleontology for centuries, it was looking at macro fossils and the macroscopic level, getting down to the microscopic and even the nano level is revolutionised what we can interpret. I think the next big step is that imaging techniques and analysing the data in a much more quicker way, because we still have a backlog where we'll scan a fish skull and get massive amounts of information. And then, like with the paper we published in Science, it took 3 years to do the rendering from the synchrotron work before we could publish it, because it was a hell of a lot of work to interpret that data and to render the individual slices. So I can see big breakthroughs coming in the future where that sort of process will be sped up, because we're dealing at such a fine scale that it takes so much time to process the information. What do you think about that, Tim?
So the first thing that sprang to my mind is that you you always see through history that, you know, visualization, a new type of visualization precedes a change in concept or some big leap forward in science or even in art. And I think what we're seeing now are some very nice ways of collecting very interesting bits of data. And for me, what's driving it is not only the immediacy of that data, but the opportunity to ask really big, deep questions about where the data came from. And actually, crowdsourcing is another thing, I think. I think, Phil, you brought that out very nicely. You have an opportunity to expose the entire world to, you know, a very uniform, very consistent scientific view of data. And I think that's a very nice opportunity for everyone.
Thanks. Oh, yes?
My favourite one in meteorites in terms of scale is people a long time ago realised there were these bizarre tiny little grains in meteorites that have a completely different isotopic composition to everything else that we see in the solar system. And some of these things, or most of these things, are submicron in size. So you need a really good microscope to see them. Folks realised that they're actually pre-solar. So this was material formed in the atmospheres of other stars or in supernovae that was dumped in our region of the galaxy, and then our solar system formed from a collection of some of this. And folks have used the composition of this material to actually work out galactic chemical evolution. So you've got like submicron grains that you can actually tease out information, kind of ground truth information on the chemical evolution of the whole galaxy, which
kind of blows me away. Yeah.
Now we have our first question up the back. Before I take it, I'll just remind you, we're lucky actually, we've got plenty of time for questions, but if you wouldn't mind confining your question to an actual question rather than making a statement. So the gentleman up the back.
Phil, you'll be pleased to know that your work was described on the Science Show yesterday. The repeat's on Monday at 2. And the person from the Natural History Museum in London described the moon as being one of the origins, in fact, only the second time in history that a piece of moon was found in Australia, actually here in South Australia. How can you tell that something's from Mars or from the moon or from an asteroid? It's not by tracking it from space. How?
That's a really good question, mate. For Mars, it's the ages of those rocks. So Martian meteorites are actually the only ones that are geologically young. So hundreds of millions of years rather than billions of years. And for that, you need an object in the solar system that's retained its heat over the history of the solar system, and that means it's got to be big. So that narrows you down to a terrestrial planet. For those meteorites, we were lucky that the Viking lander actually measured composition of the Martian atmosphere very accurately. And so we've got, and it turns out we've got little inclusions in the meteorites that we can measure trace gases in there, and there's a really nice match between those and the Martian atmosphere. So we got that. For the lunar ones, actually there was a bunch of these that were in collections before the Apollo mission. So happily the Apollo mission director or whatever didn't know about it, so there was still a justification to go to the moon, which I was really glad about because I love human spaceflight. But it meant that we've got samples that you can directly compare to stuff that was brought back from the moon. So I hope that's...
If you would like to ask a question, just... And we have one over here. I've got a few more of my own, but I'll wait till we have a bit more time.
Hello. Asteroid question, I suppose. I was reading last year about a particular range of asteroid showers where it... apparently could be tracked back to a common source, a particular large object somewhere near Jupiter which broke up. I'd be interested in seeing a visualisation of that, trying to sort of go backwards from where these showers ended up to where they've originated from.
That's a really good question. There's a whole field of research in planetary science with where dynamicists try and essentially do that exactly, which is tie fragments of asteroids back to a single kind of impact event, and they call them asteroid families. And families of asteroids kind of are probably born and die over the period of about 1 billion years, and gradually that material gets hoovered up in the inner solar system. But essentially it works exactly like you've said. You can run a simulation and kind of see where this stuff originated and roughly the time that it originated.
I've got a paleontology question. Creatures like Tiktaalik, how many different species of creature do we find now that are representative of that transition from the sea to the land? Do we find lots of different species, or are they still fairly rare?
No, we've got quite a few. Tiktaalik belongs in a group called the Elpistus degaliidae, of which we've got about a dozen fish and about half a dozen different basal tetrapods that have the same skull pattern, whether you're a fish or a tetrapod, the same limb pattern. The only difference is some have digits, some have fin rays, and some have both, fin rays and digits. And that's Pandorictus. So from the most primitive to the most advanced, we see every possible transitional phase going from a fish in water to an amphibian that's in water to then an amphibian on land. So it's pretty well nailed it. Gogonasus was an interesting find because most of these fish like Tiktaalik are more or less crushed and a little bit two-dimensional, and delicate bones get flattened. But to have a complete skeleton of one of these fish with every single bone three-dimensionally perfect meant we were able to do a much more deeper research into things like the physiology of their air-breathing capabilities and their cellular structure and so on. So we're still ironing out parts of that transition. We know the skeletal story really well. The physiological story is what we're working on next. Good question.
I'm getting a sense from listening to all three of you that these new technologies give you huge quantities of data. And so my question is, how do you decide which data is worthwhile studying and which data you need to discard?
You never throw data away. Full stop. And in fact, it asks a bigger question. And the way I approach this is that we're often publicly funded scientists, so we collect data. And the data we put in our databases should be accessible to public and all, in the same way as a museum and art gallery is a repository of different sorts of human endeavours, but scientific data is in the same set. So to answer your question directly, don't throw data away, you keep it all. In some rare cases, you collect so much data, it's not physically possible to process it all at once, and I'm thinking of the Large Hadron Collider, where the processing was distributed around the world, or in the case of the SKA. In that case, there is some data compression needed, but you know, the data you're looking for, the signal you're looking for in that case is very much larger scale. And, you know, there's some noise reduction that's always a consequence of data collection anyway.
You know, we might have a mountain of data with all this scanning and paleontological stuff, but what drives what we do is the questions we want to answer. So what's the problem we want to solve? And then we hone in on that data to the regions that might inform that question. We keep all the data, like Tim said, but we're clearly driven by the kinds of questions we need to answer.
For the project that I'm doing with the shooting stars, which is not technically the right, we initially were going to throw away most of it, and that was simply because we couldn't process it, we couldn't store it. So we were just going to keep the fireball data, which was kind of the main point of the project. But now storage and processing power has got to the point where we can actually keep everything. So we can keep an entire year's data set on a camera. And basically the plan is that we keep all of that in a storage facility and then make that available to any of the scientists that are interested. Our chairperson studies orbital debris, and it was recently brought to my attention that we can use the network to look at orbital debris. So it'll mean that people can actually zoom in for their own research questions on this same data set, which will be really exciting.
Before our next question, I might just add something to that, which from the perspective of an archaeologist, we have a major problem in that we have a lot of stuff. We keep the artefacts for future study, and storage room becomes fairly scarce after a little while. So then the question is, when you have the real stuff, as you would also, John, what constitutes acceptable data to collect to pass on for future researchers who might have questions that you can't even imagine right now? So that curation is quite a critical issue. We'll get to the next question.
I just want a quick comment on that. I used to work at the LA County Museum for the last 3 years in California. We had 38 million objects over 7 warehouses. It is a big problem. As a scientist, we don't collect anything from the field unless we think it's going to have value or meaning. Like, we could collect tons and tons of fossils at some sites where you can find a trilobite a minute, but there's no need, because once you've got a good population to do your study, that's where you stop. So I think it all starts with the scientist collecting the data to be responsible as to what you collect, so you've got to ensure it's going to be properly conserved.
And I think, as Tim said, there are sort of ethical dimensions to that collection exactly. Now, we have one question here and then two behind. So we'll start with the gentleman on this side.
Very interesting presentations, and it's interesting to see that all three disciplines are dealing in big data, and what you've been able to do is present that information in a concise, graphical way for the audience so we can engage. I'm just curious to know who do you work with to decide on how you should visualise that information, because it's the way it was presented today is very engaging, but it's quite an artistic feat to be able to present it to us.
My pet subject. I love this one. I'd start from the premise that there's no difference between an artist and a scientist. We could have a long debate about that. The medium might change, but basically the way one observes and dissects the world to re-portray it is the same human process in both cases. So, yes, we work with artists. We have a couple of resident artists in our department. In fact, one notable one I mentioned, Eric, a second. So that comes into it. It's a different perspective. But in the end, you must train yourself to portray the data to sell the message you wish to sell. Now, that comes back to another issue. You have to preserve all the raw data so someone can reinterpret it. That's an ethical issue.
In terms of how do you visualise it and which kinds of information you try and pull out, my kind of modus operandi really is just to try and collaborate with as many people as I can. So you get your own perspective is quite narrow, but by talking to many other people, you can get very different perspectives on the same data set. So that is useful for me.
In terms of visualisation in paleontology, a lot of it was purely economics, that most journals would publish in black and white or in 2D. Now, with online access journals and scientific publishing, we've got access to upload three-dimensional movies, colour plates, whatever we want to get. So it's really about, you're publishing a new discovery. It's about convincing the peers that are going to review the paper that your data is convincing enough. So that's why good visualization is so important, to portray those morphological features or characters you want to portray as being important to in your narrative story. Yeah.
Sorry, that is a subjective process, I admit it. Just one thing, I want to mention our app that we're going to bring out soon too. And it allows you to connect directly to a supercomputer in Canberra and drive some of these big data sets remotely. They're, hundreds of gigabytes in some cases, you wouldn't know because you can drive it on your iPad. So it's about bringing data, making it more accessible.
Totally cool. I want an app of my own. Our next question, please.
Is the technology available yet to do the 3D imaging and the physical and chemical analysis at the same time on the internal structures?
Yeah. Yes and no. Scientists generally never rely on a single technique to give a simple image. In our case, we will scan with X-rays, and the problem with X-rays, you lose a lot of the compositional information. You get great structural information. So we have techniques where we rely on other imaging techniques that are more sensitive to chemical and compositional background, and superimpose that and overlay that on top of the 3D data. So,
yeah, I've got a good example of how it can be used together. The synchrotron in San Francisco with Berkeley or Stanford, one of them, they recently did a synchrotron element map of the fossil Archaeopteryx, one of the earliest reptile birds, and they could map the isotopic composition as they were imaging it and actually work out the colour of its plumage because of the metallic sheen of certain isotopes. There are machines that can do both for a specific requirement, but not necessarily do an image and analyse it down to any particular elemental isotope you want. That requires, as Tim said, several different machines to get that job done.
I might ask one of my own questions, unless there's anybody else has something burning. Ah, yes, we do.
Phil, could you set your night sky thing up as a early warning system for asteroids that might be coming to Earth? Like,
I guess in a sense, when we see a fireball, we know we're going to get hit. So. Okay, this is a gag, so don't worry, I will answer your question. You've got like 2 minutes before it impacts the Earth and you get vaporized. But I've got a feeling actually and we won't be able to quantify this really until we've got that data on the big storage facility, is tracking asteroids, with this network, and it's never really been attempted before, but I think there's a chance we can do that. Although there's already been a really big kind of global effort to nail down, are there threatening asteroids? And pretty much what we can say is that I think it's 95% probability that over the next 100 years we're not going to get hit by something bigger than a kilometer. Well, okay, I said that all in one go. And that's good, because a kilometre-sized asteroid is basically big enough to kind of knock out global crop production for a year or two, which would be the biggest threat to large human populations.
Okay, well, I'm going to ask a question now, which might sadly reveal my inner maths nerd, but Tim, you're an applied mathematician. Could you, in simple words tell us something about the kinds of mathematics that you use to do some of these things.
Yes, I can, but I have to disclose publicly I'm a complete fraud. I'm actually a chemist, believe it or not. So, I mean, it's a nice story for people thinking of undertaking science. You can go anywhere with science, and I started as a chemist. So the maths that we deal with happens at a number of levels. So we're working typically with what we call abstract structures, things that are defined by as minimal surfaces where they occupy... I need graphics to show you these things, but basically they're mathematical constructs that, which are abstract, and yet they're found in nature. And one of the best examples, two examples I can think of, are mitochondria and the photosynthetic membranes within plants. Now, these are the energy sources of these organisms, and what they need to do, of course, is increase the power density. Like in your battery, you need a very big surface area and a very small volume. And so they've constructed these very convoluted membranes that have a very high specific surface area in a very compact region. And that's the sort of maths that we study in an abstract sense, but then look for it in nature and then, you know, try and adapt what we know from that more abstract approach. And there's a computational, and also an experimental side to what we do.
Experimental maths, excellent. Would anyone else like to ask? Oh, yes, down here. Oh, two down here. We'll start with the gentleman and then with the other person.
One thing that's standing out for me is that you've really broken out of the boundaries of separate sciences. What's really enabled that? What's really enabled that process of collaboration and working across?
Strangely enough, all three of us are going to be working together next year. And the commonality is the desert. We're going out there to put up fireball network cameras. We're going out to collect fossils and then image them. But I think it all starts with the fact that in your discipline, when you get to sort of the cutting edge of what you can do, you always want to do more. And you're looking for what's the next big thing that we can do that will give us more information, that might give us another side of the story we haven't already got. I gave a lecture a while ago talking about... The sort of the way paleontology is going into cross-disciplinary collaborations with chemists, with biologists, with physicists, with engineers, biomechanical modelling and all of this sort of thing. And it's giving us completely new interpretations on the critical questions of evolution. For example, Archaeopteryx is often argued, is it the first bird or is it just a dinosaur with feathers? Fundamentally, skeletally, it's a dinosaur with feathers. But could it fly or could it fly by itself? Biomechanical modelling of its bones can now answer that question, that it had enough thrust to actually push itself up. With the first thrust down of the wings, it could then take to the air and fly. So that's where you draw the line of the first bird versus the dinosaurs. Biomechanics and engineering solve that problem, not any other discipline. So there are wonderful collaborations in all the sciences now, I think, with many of the other areas of science. And as Thomas Kuhn said in his book on scientific revolutions, it's got to be at the periphery of the cross of other disciplines where you make the big breakthroughs.
Great answer. Now, this will be our final question for the afternoon.
Just a simple question, please, sir. There was a retired Presbyterian minister, lived in the Blue Mountains behind Sydney. He was an amateur astronomer, and he discovered things in the skies and sent it on to NASA. What things? Black hole things. He was able to do it. Do you know anything about this minister up in the Blue Mountains, whether he's still alive?
I actually don't. No, I'm sorry. I'd like to find out about that. I mean, it is a fact that in Australia there've been many very gifted amateur astronomers who've made real amazing contributions, and comets named after them, you name it. So, but I'd like to find out about that one. Yeah.
I mean, there might be people in the audience to know the story a little bit better. Yes, he's a comet gazer as well, supernovas. He's got such visual acuity and good memory that he can remember the sky photographically in his mind, night after night, season after season. So he's one of many remarkable individuals that contribute to that.
Well, I fear we may have to leave our questions here. If people would like to continue speaking to our three wonderful speakers, I believe they will be present at other events during the festival, and maybe you can even catch them outside the 5 o'clock Think and Drink at the Festival Club. How about that? So this brings us to the end of this afternoon's session. I would like you to join me in thanking our three inspiring and creative and also scientific speakers for today.
This session of the 2013 Adelaide Festival of Ideas was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.